Welcome, everybody, to another exciting edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Spicer, and we have a great cast for you today. My guest is from the studio Harebrain Schemes, who have been making a name for themselves not only with bringing back some classic games, but also having a very successful track record on Kickstarter. They are currently up to 4 successful Kickstarter projects, with one going to be finishing up probably in a few days from when you hear this cast. Please welcome from Harebrain Schemes, co-founder and studio manager, Mitch Gittleman.
Hey there.
Hey, Mitch. It's great to have you on.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Yeah, definitely. So, normally when we have guests on with Kickstarters going on, I usually say, I wish you guys good luck. I hope it turns out well. But at this point, you guys have not only succeeded, but you've gone way over. So definitely congratulations for Kickstarter number 4.
Oh, thanks. It's pretty exciting. The whole studio is really energized by it.
Yeah, definitely. And for those of you listening to the cast either at the time of the posting or down the line, we are referring to the BattleTech Kickstarter, which at this current time of recording has just broken the $2 million mark on Kickstarter.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, definitely. And especially since you guys were only asking for $250,000 to begin with. So definitely very impressive. And as I said a few seconds ago, this is not Harebrain Schemes' first Kickstarter. And we're definitely going to be talking about the level of success you guys have had with the crowdfunding platform later in the cast.
Great.
So, to get the ball rolling, Mitch, since this is your first time on, could you tell everyone who's listening a little bit about yourself, your background in the industry, and just what is Harebrain Schemes?
Sure. Well, let's start with my beard is gray. I started in games for money in 1993, so we're coming up on 25 years for me. I started in the paper and pencil role-playing game industry, which is how I met my partner, Jordan Weissman, the creator of BattleTech in the first place, because BattleTech started as a board game and role-playing game called MechWarrior and BattleTech and MechWarrior, respectively. Anyway, so I started writing paper and pencil role-playing games and then moved into video games, and I've been doing nothing but video games ever since. I think my first title was a first wave title, is what they call it, for the PlayStation 1, just to give you a sense of the time and place. And yeah, I've done stuff for the PlayStation and for Mac and PC. I started working with Jordan at Facet Interactive around, 97, where I led development of Mech Commander, which is a real-time strategy game that takes place in the BattleTech universe. So that's the first time we actually worked together on a video game, and I did a couple more of those. Around 1999, Microsoft bought FASA Interactive, went out there where I did Mech Commander 2, shipped Mech Assault, Crimson Skies. Jordan and I created Crimson Skies together.
Oh, yeah.
And I helped out with the development of Crimson Skies, so you may have heard of those. After we closed FASA Studio at Microsoft, I went on to be the head of Xbox Live Arcade on Xbox, where you could download great games there and that whole business. And I was on the team that helped redesign the Xbox dashboard.
Ah, interesting.
And added all the avatars to Xbox and stuff like that. Then I went on to found another internal studio at Microsoft, internal external studio, where we did Xbox Live games. We actually, instead of just publishing them, we made them internally and externally. And then I worked on a game called One Versus 100 there, which was really cool because up to 250,000 people could play that. And that was just sort of an overseeing thing, unfortunately. I didn't really have much to do with that, which is too bad. It was very cool. Anyway, after that, I left Microsoft. I did some consulting for Bungie on Destiny. And it was actually the guy who runs Bungie that suggested that I start working with Jordan again. And we made a mobile title called Crimson Steam Pirates, published by Bungie. You can still find it on app stores. And we had so much fun making that game we just looked at each other one day and said, let's just stay together and make games. And that's how Harebrained Schemes was founded. It was about 8 or 10 of us in a rental. We rented out another game developer's storage closet and stuck some people in it. Mm-hmm. And that's it. I mean, we made Crimson Steam Pirates in 12 weeks in a storage closet. And, you know, it's gone on from there. So far, so good.
Yeah. It's always interesting to hear the different, the different origin stories of the various indie studios. I've spoken to like a couple who they actually lived in a treehouse for like 3 years and they're making their first game. And it's always exciting to hear how a lot of these studios really get off the ground, because we've talked about this so many times with different developers on the cast, but there really is no checklist really to getting into game development or becoming an indie developer. Everyone has their own unique and interesting story.
And, especially now, you know, everything's so egalitarian now. All these tools are available to you at very low prices. Yeah. Anybody can get onto one of the app stores or even Steam, you know. It's great for game development in that anybody can make a game and get it out there and try and find an audience. And then there's also the crowdfunding element. So you can anybody can try and get some money to do it. At the same time, it becomes an incredibly crowded marketplace.
Definitely.
Right. And so there are thousands and thousands of competitive titles trying to, you know, get people's eyeballs. And, you know, that's not just video games. Now with Netflix, et cetera, it's just digitally consuming content.
Yeah.
And so if you think about it, anything that vies for your time is competition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ben. We've talked about this again on the cast so many times before, but I mean, my Steam list has ballooned from like several hundred. I think I've gone over 1,000 games on Steam, Humble Bundle, the whole deal. And even with Kickstarter is another good example. 2-3 years ago, there was barely any video game presence on there.
Right.
And now we've seen dozens, if not, well, actually, it's probably like hundreds, if not thousands, of Kickstarter projects for games on there.
Mm-hmm.
And not only do you have that challenge, but you also have the state of the market, because when everyone can get on there, it really affects the quality of the products.
It also affects sales dramatically. You know, here we are coming out with very high quality games, like Shadowrun Hong Kong, for example. I don't know what the average review score is, but it's about 85, something like that, a very strong review score, right? And yet, the way people consume games now, there's easily 100,000 people that have it on their wish list, right, that aren't going to buy it. They're waiting for a sale.
Yeah, of course.
You know? And everybody just waits for these sales, and then they just make, you know, they just buy a stack of games. Mm-hmm. So they have this library of games, and it's a very challenging time to be a game developer and make money.
Yeah, that's the important part right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, the challenge, as you just said, Mitch, with pricing is a very big deal. We've seen, I mean, you talk about getting into the industry around 93. That was during the time where games were like $70, $80, and that was it. There was no such thing as sales. And today, as you just said, with like the bundle, you can buy like 20, 30 games for like $70. And I mean, to say how bad it's gone for me, at the last like big Steam sale, I think it was like the summer sale.
Yeah.
Everything was already bought by me. There's nothing more for me to buy.
Wow.
And that definitely is a concern when all the games on sale is like, wait, I already bought all this. And it's even got a point where I bought games on other digital platforms without realizing I already bought it on Steam or somewhere else. There's just so much content going on that it's crazy. And with the pricing, one of the big issues we're seeing is trying to figure out how to price these games. Because as you said, we have all kinds of things vying for our attention, so spending $50 on one game doesn't really make that much sense anymore. And for me, I can't really spend full price on a game because I have 20, 30 games still in my backlog I need to play, so I can wait, and then I buy those games on sale, and then the whole cycle just repeats over and over again.
I wish it was only that bad.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the late Steve Jobs really helped the race to the bottom, you know, with these $1 games or free games, and then the rise of freemium mm-hmm. or free-to-play games. So now you get these real quality things that you expect to pay nothing or close mm-hmm. to nothing. And yet the cost of making games has not lowered.
Oh, yeah.
You know, now granted, you know, with things like Unity or Unreal, et cetera, these engines, that has really given developers like me and others a leg up. Mm-hmm. But it's a race to the bottom with the prices. And yet game developers are in such high demand mm-hmm. that it's very difficult to get a studio filled with people that you can afford to make these things with. So, again, it's an extremely challenging time to be a video game developer.
Yeah, and that's why we see so many developers go the indie route, where they do have complete control. They can work with people that they know and trust who can put together an amazing game, but then there's still that problem of selling it. I've seen people complain when a game is $15 or $10, and it's insane. Again,
it's simple. It's on the internet, therefore it should be free.
Exactly.
It's that simple.
Yeah.
Right? Look at music, look at books, ebooks, everything. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all the same thing. If I can download it, if there's no physical media, mm-hmm. by that logic, it's really only worth free. Mm-hmm. As opposed to the millions of dollars in development that actually went into it.
Yeah, there's definitely that sense of perception with digital versus physical goods. And
yes,
there's a huge debate about, you know, digital ownership. Do you really own your copies? I know there's been discussions in Europe about how people do have, I believe they do have the right to sell digital copies in Europe, or they have something to do over there.
Mm-hmm.
But we still don't have that over here, and it's still a very interesting time. There's talking about digital, one of the big things has definitely been, like, as you said, freemium, microtransactions, and even post-game support is a really big deal these days. Again, we can talk about the 90s and early 2000s, where you release a game, and that's it. It's pretty much done, barring critical patches or maybe a $3 expansion.
Oh, yeah. When we did Mech Commander 1, I remember my boss saying, if we put out a patch, we admit failure.
Mm.
As opposed to, how about some customer service?
Yeah.
You know, et cetera. Yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, today we have games with day zero patches, games with 20 patches, and let's, of course, talk about microtransactions. We see so many games being boosted and supported for years to come. I mean, Team Fortress, I think, just celebrated its 7-year anniversary last year. I mean, that is just mind-boggling.
That one deserves it.
Yeah.
You know, that's a great example of how to do free-to-play microtransactions right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doesn't affect gameplay at all. It's a great game. You know, of course it's a great game. You know, it doesn't last that long without being a great
game.
You know.
Yeah, and when we talk about that stuff, usually games that last that long were reserved for MMOs, like World of Warcraft, EverQuest, etc. But today, many people expect you to keep working on your game for the long run. If they see that, oh, you're just going to release a game and be done with it, they expect, you know, 5-6 more months of content sometimes.
Well, maybe not content, but at least support. Yes. They need to feel that the game is supported. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that goes into this whole newfangled way of thinking about it, which is games as a service.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. So, and you'll see that in the games that we made here at Harebrained Schemes. Just about every single one of them behaves like a game as a service.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's definitely that changing mindset. For those of you listening to this cast, like, later on, there's a huge debate going on with the game Payday 2 and how they've been trying to add microtransactions into the game along with their downloadable content model. And it's caused a major clash between consumer and developer. And there are still a lot of people out there who despise anything downloadable content, microtransactions, as you just said, Mitch, the whole games as a service. They will fight that tooth and nail for some audiences.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And everybody's entitled to their opinions and their beliefs. The thing that everybody has to keep in mind is that, you know, game development is arduous and very expensive. Mm-hmm. And with these prices going down, yet the cost of development is going up.
Yeah.
You know, independent game developers, everybody, they need to figure out a way of making a business model that works.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you vote with your dollars, and of course you let people know when they are not behaving properly.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to be allowed to experiment with different models to find a way of surviving, or we're going to see a lot of game developers closing up shop, even successful game developers, public perception-wise.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a real economic problem.
Definitely.
And it's one that needs to be dealt with, but it's going to evolve over time. I've got nothing at all personally mm-hmm. against free-to-play microtransaction games as long as they provide real value.
Mm-hmm.
The things you're paying for are actually worth it. And as long as the people that are paying the money are happy about it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's a quality game, then what is the problem? And mm-hmm. in terms of DLC, you know, I've made quite a few DLC. Actually, I actually made the very first DLC ever on console.
Mm.
That was in a DLC and paid DLC. Did both of them mm-hmm. For Mech Assault, mm-hmm. the original, because it was the very first game on Xbox Live.
Mm-hmm.
So it was our job to experiment with new ways of doing it. So, yeah, it's a tough animal. But the idea, for example, day one DLC, and day one DLC, we should have it for free. That's, you know, that's not an opinion I share.
Mm.
You know, a game, for example, on day one, that game was finished a ways back, and on, you know, and the team moved on, and if they got the DLC done on day one, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's sort of like for me, and I haven't thought about this too deeply, but it's sort of like buying a car.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to buy a car, and the guy says, "Okay, here's everything that's included. Do you want the car? You can have it today." And I say, yes. He says, okay, mm-hmm. one more thing. You could also have this insurance package. You know, it's bumper to bumper insurance. You can buy that too. Do you want that? And then I get to say, no, I don't want that. Or, yes, I do want that. And I get what I pay for.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what the controversy about day one DLC is. Mm-hmm. Like it should be, you know, in the game at the same price as the original game. Well, for me, if I'm going to do that, I'm going to have to raise the price of the base game.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody is forced to take that. So that actually removes the freedom of choice from the audience. And I'm not sure that's necessarily the best thing either.
Yeah. Part of the problem, as you said, Mitch, is like the preconception that goes behind game development. I want to go back briefly to what you just said a minute ago regarding the perception of a successful studio. And this is something that we've seen time and time again. There's a big difference between a studio that is successful because they made a great game and who's successful because they have enough money that they're able to support the studio. I've mm-hmm. spoken to so many developers, especially some who have been on the cast previously, who have had trouble balancing those two out. One guy I spoke to from Arkane Games, Chris Park, he talked about like the first year I interviewed him, he was having a lot of trouble with that. And he even made a huge post breakdown on his site about some of the financial troubles they were having. And mm-hmm. this was a studio that had a very commercially successful game. But
what was the name of the game?
AI Wars from Arkane Games. And
thanks.
That game was so popular, it's basically sustained them for the periods where they weren't doing well.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And again, if you make a great game, it doesn't mean you're going to make a great game that's going to sell.
Oh, no.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no. Or movie, or any other form of entertainment.
Oh, yeah, we've seen, there's too many examples to go into about that.
No.
Yeah.
Citizen Kane would tank today
mm-hmm.
if that movie came out. You know, there's a lot of, you know, that's just the nature of the beast, yeah.
Yeah. And going back to what you just said a second ago regarding on-disc DLC or day one DLC, part of the problem, I think, as you just said, is I guess the quote-unquote grand mystery of game development. There's still a lot
of
people who don't know how games work. And
of course not.
Yeah, and Kickstarter has also, I think, sort of hurt that as well, because when you have everyone pitching different ideas with different budgets in mind, it's very hard to get an understanding of what goes into making a game. Two big examples like lately in terms of this podcast would be like Bloodborne and Yooka-Laylee, who were, you know, they had like AAA level graphics and support, but they were only asking like $400,000-$500,000. Mm-hmm. And then you have something like Shenmue 3 that I think they were only asking like $250,000 at the start, or $1 million. And again, because everyone has things differently, you can't really get a proper baseline to, you know, you need X amount of money to make this type of game or so.
Well, what they're actually doing is misrepresenting how much it costs to make a game, which furthers the mythology, you know, or the mystery of game development. You know, games at the level that we work at, you know, cost easily $4 million to make. You know, at this level, at the Shenmue level, you know, I don't even know. Let's just say $10 million or so, or Bloodborne, maybe $10 million.
Yeah.
I'm not sure because, you know, I haven't looked under the hood at what they're doing. But these things cost a lot of money. So to say, oh, you know, we want, we only need $500,000 to make this game or something like that, actually misrepresents the process and leads to consumers who are not educated.
Yeah. And this goes back to what you were saying a few minutes ago with that misconception between physical and digital goods. They think that if a game is online, it should be free or $2. They don't understand.
Or it costs less to make.
Exactly.
So it costs less to manufacture, yes, but not to make.
Definitely. And what you just said regarding Shenmue, I know the original Shenmue was considered the most expensive video game for the time. Now, this was, of course, before Grand Theft Auto, and Oblivion and all those games. But yeah, it's definitely a huge mystery. And I would love to spend like the next hour or two talking about it. But if we get more on this topic, we'll be here probably until the Kickstarter is done.
Definitely.
Before we move on, I would love to talk to you more about your work on, you said Xbox Live or Xbox Live Arcade?
Both.
I would love to talk more about that, but I think that may take us too far off track, especially when we try to keep this for about an hour.
Well, maybe another day.
Yep, definitely. All right. I'm trying to think if there's any other studio questions before we move on. And I think the rest I have will probably lead into talking more about Kickstarter and crowdfunding, because I'm sure we're going to spend probably the bulk of our time together today on that, because it is a very interesting thing. And as you said, as we've been talking about with pricing and development, it's really opened up a lot of doors and interesting situations. So let's move on and talk a little bit about Kickstarter. And for those of you listening to the cast, I'm probably going to ask Mitch a few of the questions that I ask a lot of the developers who I've had on. So I'm curious to get your answers to these questions. Again, because Harebrain has had not one, but technically four successful Kickstarters as of this time. I guess my first question is, as you talked about with forming Harebrain Schemes and getting together everyone to make that, when you started to approach making games like Shadowrun Returns and BattleTech, did you have in mind to go to Kickstarter with these projects beforehand? Or did the use of Kickstarter sort of happen while developing these games?
Oh, sure. So we had been making mobile games before Shadowrun Returns. We made a game called Strike Fleet Omega, Crimson Steam Pirates, very, very well-received games. But we realized quickly that the market for mobile games was changing, and the type of games we really wanted to develop weren't there yet. So while we were working on Strike Fleet Omega, available now on your App Store, our lead engineer, our chief technology officer, Chris Conert, was on Kickstarter, and remember, this is the very early days of Kickstarter, and he was tooling around, and he had backed a couple of projects. He says, have you seen this yet? And I'm looking over his shoulder, and I get a twinkle in my eye. He's like, nope, 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 no, do not make a video game Kickstarter. Do not. Nobody had.
Yeah, that's a strange thing
time.
Now.
Nobody had, and I said, never say never, man. And so that was in like October or November, I think, of 2011. And we had a partners meeting. My partner Jordan, who's the CEO, and my partner Joe, who is the CFO. Joe is formerly from Disney Imagineering. And we had a talk one day, and they said, well, you know, where do you want this company to go? What do you want to do? And I'm the one who spoke up and said, here's what I want to do. I want to find a dedicated audience. I don't care the size of the audience. All I care is that they're dedicated, and I want to make games for them, and I want to keep them for life, right, so that they buy all our games. And, you know, that's how we'll continue to make money, just by finding an audience and satisfying that audience. And so I think what we should do is take Shadowrun and bring it to Kickstarter. And then once we've done that and established ourselves, we'll just keep going, making more stuff like that, and the audience will like us and blah, 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 blah. And at the time, nobody had done it yet. And Jordan was not a big fan of creating games under a microscope, which is completely understandable. Having worked with publishers before, there are microscopes plenty probing. You don't really need, you know, 30,000 fans doing that too. So we shelved it for a while. And then, like, around that March, that's when Tim Schafer did his, and he raised $3.3 million. And that happened. And then two other things happened in that same week. One was that Kotaku ran an article that just said the top 10 games we wish would come back. And number five was Shadowrun. And then that same week, without reading that, the publisher we were working with said, when are you guys going to make a Shadowrun game? I want to publish a Shadowrun game. And Jordan just sort of shrugged and said, go ahead. And that's when we went and did Shadowrun Returns. And that's how that whole thing was born. But, you know, you got to understand, we were like the number three. I think I'm right. We were the third game to break $1 million on Kickstarter. And therefore, we had no clue what we were doing. We just made it up as we went along, sort of just making our path as we went. And, you know, and we screwed it up horribly. And it was a joyous event. It was one of the most exciting periods of my entire life. And I would do it again if I had the shot.
Yeah. And with Shadowrun, I remember, I also get to date myself on this cast. I remember playing it for the Super Nintendo, that version. And it's very interesting, again, talking about these classic series and bringing them back, because that's one of the things we really seen Kickstarter help with. There's just too many games, my mind is just blanking, but I would say is even like The Darkest Dungeon, with trying to go back to like that classic dungeon crawling style games.
Yeah, those guys are great.
Oh yeah, I've spoken to them a lot, and I'm trying to get them back on now, but they're in basically crunch mode to get the game officially done by the end of the year.
Yeah, I know. They're actually pretty much down the street from us.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the Shadowrun Returns Kickstarter right now. I can see you guys, I see the amount of money that you raised. How much did you ask originally for Shadowrun?
$400,000.
All right.
But that wasn't because we were playing anybody. The game that we pitched was actually a very small, very, very humble game. And through the Kickstarter, we had no idea we were going to get the support that we got for that. It blew our hair back, and we just kept expanding the scope of the game. And so that's why it was only $400,000 to start, because we thought that's all it would take to make.
Yep, and I'm glad that you brought up about expanding the game, because that takes me to a very big question about Kickstarter and crowdfunding, and that also has to do with BattleTech, and that is stretch goals. We've seen developers had to take polarizing stances on the use of stretch goals to extend a project. On one hand, they can give a game a lot more publicity, they can help push it to go a lot further than it would have otherwise. But on the flip side, as you said, it can just balloon a game's development. And I've spoken to a lot of developers who've talked about even just making a basic game and how much things can change, not counting if you add 10, 15 stretch goals to a project. And we've seen some developers in the past buckle under the fact that they've added, you know, 20 stretch goals, and now their project is expanded exponentially from what they originally pitched and budgeted for. Now, with BattleTech, you guys said something very interesting. You staged the stretch goals almost as its own little promotional campaign, with the different stages of funding and what you would add in. There's, of course, the base game, the single player campaign expanded and so on. So there's definitely a lot here to talk about. So I guess the first question then to get this ball rolling, I guess, what do you think of using stretch goals in Kickstarter campaigns?
If the studio using them has actually done their homework and has planned for them, mm-hmm. I see absolutely nothing wrong with it. If you look at what we've done, some people could consider these stretch goals the way we did it. We don't. We think of it as co-funding with our audience for various reasons. But there's nothing wrong, in my opinion, with stretch goals. It's a matter of, did you plan for them? Are you pulling them out of your ass? And can you actually deliver what you're saying in the first place?
Yeah. And that's the other big point. When you just throw stretch goals in willy-nilly, you're just saying, oh, give us $200,000, we'll make a brand new never-seen game mode that we've never tried. It usually ends in disaster. But looking at what you guys did with your four-tier system, it definitely seems you guys have planned things out. And another question I like to ask people who do Kickstarters is, when you guys settle on doing a Kickstarter, whether it's for Shadowrun or BattleTech, how long did you spend actually preparing, you know, getting the campaign ready before actually going to Kickstarter?
Let's see. For Shadowrun Hong Kong, which we did in January, mm-hmm. we prepped for about 6 or 8 weeks. It takes that long. You have to write all the text. You have to create the art. You have to iterate on it. You have to get feedback on it. The reward levels take a lot of iteration and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it takes time. And what people don't realize, perhaps, and nor should they, is that, you know, it costs a lot of money, actually, to do a Kickstarter in the first place, right? So everybody working on it has to eat.
Yeah, of course. No one's getting paid while you're making the Kickstarter, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you said 6 to 8 weeks, because I've spoken to a lot of developers who've had different times, and I think the general consensus is that you really do need to spend the time to make a good Kickstarter, especially today, as we've talked about, with the number of developers and the ease of development growing. You really need to put your best foot forward. You can't go on Kickstarter with just a piece of paper saying, I want to make this game, give me $250,000. It's not going to work. And speaking about with the Darkest Dungeon guys, when I spoke to them, I think they spent like 6 months doing their Kickstarter. And you can really tell the difference between a Kickstarter that was hastily prepared versus the ones that hit all the marks and make it really exciting and really interesting for the consumer. Now, here's a question. I'm not sure if you'll be able to answer this one, but it's one that I'm just really curious about, especially with going back to the whole mystique of game development. With like stretch goals and expanding the projects, we've seen developers price things in all different ways. And this probably either have a really complicated or a really simple answer, but how do you like determine, or how do you sit down and price out stretch goals or content that you're obviously may or may not develop?
The way we do it, first of all, well, let's talk about our co-funding approach in general first to set the scene. What we did on Shadowrun Hong Kong and on BattleTech, we realized that it would look weird and greedy and odd to the audience if we said, hey, you know, we did these others and we were successful with them. Now just give us more money. And just to lower our risk. It doesn't, you know, it wouldn't make sense to people and it wouldn't make sense to us. So what we did instead is co-funded both of these games. With Shadowrun Hong Kong, we said we will make a minimum 12-hour game set in Hong Kong, right? We are committed to doing that. We're making that whether you fund this game or not. Now, here are things we could add to the game that you can fund, you know, to make it better, to really broaden the scope of the game. And, you know, the audience on Hong Kong just said, you know, this makes complete sense to us. And, you know, $1.2 million later, you know, we had the funds to really move the game forward. And that was great. With BattleTech, what we said was there are four funding stages to this game. The first one is a skirmish mech combat game where you use your mech lab and you load out your mechs and then you load up a map and you decide on the AI and then you can fight it out with, you know, this great turn-based tactical combat. We're paying for that. Mm-hmm. We're going to make that game, mm-hmm. whether you fund us or not. Mm. And that, I think, resonates really well with people. They say, all right, these guys are in. They've got real skin in the game. We're mm-hmm. spending well over $1 million on just that, mm-hmm. right? And then, what happens then after that is we say, now, on top of that skirmish game, mm-hmm. we could expand the skirmish game in a few different ways, and you could fund those. If you go beyond that and we hit $1 million, we'll do a single-player story. Mm. And if you're interested in a single player story, get us up to $1 million and then we will. And that's what happened. And then we had some expansions onto that that we added. You know, if we hit this next dollar amount, we could add this to the single player story or that to the single player story until we reach a stretch goal of, or a funding level, of 1.85 million. Mm-hmm. And then we do this thing, you know, that I'm just in love with, the expanded mercenary campaign.
That was really cool.
Right? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really excited to see how our designers handle that one. And, you know, here's a couple of little funding steps on top of that. Mm-hmm. On our way to stage 4, which is PvP multiplayer, mm-hmm. which I hope we hit.
Yeah. And so with that kind of co-funding mentality with the game, so how did you come up, I guess, with not only the pricing but for the stretch goals, but like which ones did you want to have? Because it would be very tempting to, you know, say, oh, we'll have a stage 5, stage 6, stage 7, do all this other stuff. But
yes, the game actually has to come out at some point.
Of course.
And so actually what we did, one of the ways we did it is we said we want to put out this game in about 18 months. Mm-hmm. Because what we've learned is if you take forever to make a game, you stop learning.
Yeah.
Right? And we like to ship. We like to learn. If you look at our track record, we have shipped a metric F-ton of games in the 4 years mm-hmm. that Harebrained Schemes has been in existence. And you learn by shipping. You learn how the team works. You learn about your craft. You improve all the time. So we set an 18-month limit on ourselves and said, what can we build within this time? Mm-hmm. And even if these funding goals are unlocked, can we do that?
Okay.
And the answer is yes. And that's how we scoped it.
Interesting.
And then from there, the individual funding levels, these goals, how do we decide whether to do them? Well, one of the biggest learnings that we've had after 3 successful Kickstarters is there is with some of these in-game funding goals, those features that you're committing to are actually for a development team a little like a straitjacket. Mm-hmm. Because as you're making video games, the idea is you've got this list of features, you design them and you prototype them and yada yada. Mm-hmm. And at some point during development, you realize, you know, this isn't working out the way I want. It's not as fun as I want. Or it's really buggy. And you say, you know what? Let's focus on this other thing and let's just cut that feature. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't do that.
Of course. Yeah.
Right? If it was one of your funding goals mm-hmm. and it becomes a straitjacket, you have to deliver that. And you have to deliver it very, very close to what you described in the first place. Or you're going to have an unhappy audience. And you should have an unhappy mm-hmm. audience, you know? So therefore, when we did this one, as you'll see, we were very careful not to go off the deep end. You know, when you do a Kickstarter, one of the very first things that happens mm-hmm. on day one, hour one, is people start asking you to add stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, here's the game we want to make. Gee, I wish you were making this game. Yeah. Add this too. Mm-hmm. And the answer is no, we're not going to. Mm. And what we've gotten good at is actually saying no to our audience.
Interesting.
And actually garnering respect for it. Mm-hmm. Now that we've delivered all these games at high review scores that are, you know, pretty damn on time for game development, mm-hmm. You know, people start to realize, hey, wait a minute, these guys actually know how to make games. Mm-hmm. And when they say they can do something, they do it. When they say that it's out of scope or they can't do it, we should probably just let it go.
Mm-hmm. And
so it's been very, very successful for us for that reason. And what's great is the audience, even people that haven't backed our Kickstarters before or don't know anything about us, when they hear us talk about this, and it's usually, you know, me, it's my job on the forums or on the Kickstarter comments page to say no. And, you know, it's like a breath of fresh air to them because they're so used to these corporations, these faceless corpses, right? Just, you know, BSing them.
Yeah,
you
sure.
Know,
we'll
taking
add,
their money.
You know, we'll add 10 more campaigns in. That will happen.
We'll do whatever.
Yeah.
But again, they're faceless and they're not used to being able to trust anybody in any walk of life. Mm-hmm. And so one of our goals for the company that is very, very important to us and is part of the reason for our current success is our integrity is extremely important to us. Mm-hmm. Having a long term, not a one night stand relationship with our audience is hugely important to us and behaving that way.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That probably will lead into a later question on the cast about how you guys have managed to have so many successful Kickstarters and build your company around it. Because again, as you were saying a few seconds ago, a lot of developers go to Kickstarter with the clear-cut strategy of we're just going to get all this money, run, you know, if it works, great. If it doesn't, we still have your money. And then they're done. They're never going to make another Kickstarter again.
And I'm not aware of many teams that do that. I've heard of only one.
Yeah.
I hope that isn't a widespread thing. In my experience with Kickstarter, it's very earnest people who really want to do what they say they want to do. They just lack the experience, you know, to be able to deliver it. And they're relying on a combination of their own wishes and the audience's wishes and warped sense of reality. And it turns out both are wrong and both get hurt.
Yeah. And as you said, it's very important to be able to say no to your audience. And
To yourself first.
Yeah, definitely.
Actually, we can be our own worst enemy.
Oh, yeah.
Feature creep is a real thing in game development. And you got to be really careful. You know, we talk about it all the time on the Kickstarter comments page. Focus equals quality.
Yeah.
And, you know, death by a thousand cuts is a very real thing.
Definitely. The example that I'm very disappointed with is what happened with Planetary Annihilation and their original release. They went with, you know, tons and tons of stretch goals. And as you said, they really did become straitjackets for them. Because the ones that got in, or actually got everyone in, and they happened at varying levels of quality. The single player campaign didn't work as originally intended. It was overblown. I didn't even miss its original launch. And going back to what you said a few minutes ago regarding having that 18-month design window for your games and saying we're going to only make what we can do within this amount of time is definitely a very smart outlook for game development, especially in terms of project development.
Well, we have to be able to also move our talented studio members between projects and you know, plan for that too. We're not a one project studio, so we have to be very cognizant of the overall health of the studio and the resource needs of all the studios, of all the projects.
All right. This next question, you may have answered this to some extent previously, but I want to reiterate it for one listening. As you're coming up with these Kickstarters, obviously we just talked about your co-funding approach and the 18-month development cycle. But this sort of leads back to what you're talking about with the misconception of like day one DLC and additional content. But for you guys, how do you determine what is going to be the initial Kickstarter pitch? You just said, of course, the dangers of feature creep and death by a thousand cuts. And we've seen a lot of developers struggle with this, with trying to decide, okay, we're going to make this game and we'll have A, B, C, and D. And then we may say E, F, G for stretch goals. But how do you decide what that original foundation is?
We started with an overall vision for BattleTech itself. You know, there's quite a love for BattleTech in the studio, especially with Jordan, who created it, you know, 32 years ago. And so when we were thinking about it, we thought, well, what is sort of the ultimate expression of BattleTech that we would like to do if we could? And we started there. And then we divided that into multiple games at a very high level. Right.
Yeah.
And then we went to the first game and said, okay, if the first game's, you know, time frame and scope is here, let's divide that into stages, right? because then it comes down to what can we make and how much will it take to make it. And once we had the focus of, okay, the skirmish game and then the single player game and then the extended skirmish game, mercenary campaign, and finally multiplayer, PvP multiplayer, once we had those broad strokes, then it was, okay, what is the base of those broad strokes and what are the additions that really are out of scope for our budget, et cetera, and or more importantly, how much will it cost to make those things?
Yeah.
You know, and so we sort of back into all of it that way. But we start with a grand vision, mm-hmm. and then just start breaking it up into its component parts.
Interesting. And it definitely sounds like you guys have really gotten this down. And I mean, we could really, again, I always love when we have these podcasts, we could spend 2 to 3 hours on every one of our topics.
Sure.
We're having so many great discussions. But I'm trying to, I definitely have some few, like, general wrap-up questions for you regarding this Kickstarter section before we move on. I guess here's a good one. As you said, when we first started talking about Kickstarter, you guys learned a lot. You obviously made some mistakes along the way. For you and the rest of the studio, in terms of the Kickstarter projects, for people listening, what were some of like the mistakes you made, or some things that, you know, hindsight and all that, you would go mm-hmm. back and correct if possible?
Well, it really comes down to that feature creep mm-hmm. and not doing your homework before you add something, mm-hmm. because somebody's got to make that stuff. And I would say that, you know, Jordan and I are really responsible for the team working extremely hard in order to deliver on our promises. Mm-hmm. And if I could take back one thing, it would be that. It was to do more diligence, etc. on it. Mm-hmm. Because Shadowrun Returns, we were creating a brand new game from scratch, from blank hard drives, mm-hmm. on a new engine we had never used before. We had to do an editor. We had to create a complete RPG story. And we did it in 1 year. Mm-hmm. And if you know anything about game development, that's stupid. Mm-hmm. And it involved a lot of nights and a lot of weekends and a lot of hardship for not only the game developers, but just as importantly, for their families. Mm-hmm. Right? There are people here with young children, et cetera, et cetera. And even if they don't have families, because I don't want to just talk all about the family people, even if not, it still takes over your life, so that every waking moment is spent just thinking about your game, and you're not living a full life. And people like me are responsible for that kind of behavior. And so every mistake that we've ever made on a Kickstarter really comes down to just that thing. There are people that have to deliver on it, and it's going to hurt. It's either going to take more time, which we can't necessarily afford, mm-hmm. or it's just going to take more effort, which is what eventually happens. So even on Shadowrun Hong Kong, which was an extremely well-structured and well-run Kickstarter, mm-hmm. Everything went very well. But even what happened was, even when we made like one little mistake, I was like, oh, that cost us a couple of weeks of development. Well, that couple of weeks of development actually resulted in a lot of crunch time for people. So that doesn't matter to Kickstarter backers or anything. And we delivered exactly what we said, but that's how it happens. That's where the rubber really meets the road. Whatever mistake you make, the team is paying for it. And that is why when we talk about our physical and digital rewards for BattleTech, you know, we say no a lot. Well, couldn't you just add this, or couldn't you just add that? For physical rewards digital rewards, you'll make a lot of money if you do that. But the answer is, somebody has to make that, and it is the team. And more important than that, it will detract from making the game. These people are game developers, not merchants. And so they should be focusing all their energies on making the highest quality game they can. And that is why we're extremely focused with our Kickstarter rewards, and why we really don't do anything that isn't, you know, well vetted and well planned, especially because the cost of those things can be really hidden.
Oh yeah.
and some reward that, oh, wow, we added $50,000 with that reward. Yeah, but you know what? That reward actually cost $60,000 to make. So congratulations.
Yeah.
You just lost $10,000.
Oh, yeah.
But to everybody, it looks like you made 50, and they're wondering where all that stuff is in the game.
Yeah, definitely. Physical goods is in of itself its own little quagmire for a lot of developers.
It is.
I spoke with, I forget his name, from, I think, was it Human Nature Studios, the one who's doing the Toe Jam and Earl revival.
Oh, wow.
And he talked about how he spent months going to, like, different manufacturers,
uh-huh,
different places to get the exact shipping cost, the exact production,
yep,
cost, the whole,
yep,
deal.
And even so, he was probably wrong. Those shipping costs, no, really.
Yeah.
During the course of Shadowrun Returns, for example, the shipping costs changed. And our costs increased by, I think, as much as, and I'm not exaggerating, 30%. Yeah. So that Kickstarter cost us an arm and a leg from unknown costs. And then there was a strike or something, a stevedore strike, and the Eastern Seaboard, and all the ships coming from China with the product were delayed for weeks, etc. You know, and just that kind of crap's just out of your hands. It's horrible.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, as you said earlier, a lot of Kickstarter developers, they may not think about this, or they may not do enough due diligence on it, and it can come back to bite you very quickly.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. To wrap up the section, just some few more general questions. These are ones that I like to ask a lot of our developers who we've had on. So the first one is, for any enthusiasts or other developers listening to this cast who are interested in Kickstarter for themselves, do you have any words of wisdoms or any guidance you could give to those people who are thinking about doing their first Kickstarter project?
Go where the audience is. Mm-hmm. You have to pre-market your Kickstarter. The whole thing with entertainment these days is you have to cut through the noise.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. You have to find your audience, and you can't do it by, you know, flies and honey. You can't just say, here's the honey flies, come get it. Mm-hmm. You have to go where they are.
Yeah.
So you have to find your audience, or an audience like your audience, and promote to them. Mm-hmm. Because everybody and their brother is knocking on your door with all sorts of digital content. You gotta say very loudly, we are here and we are different. And the other thing is, you better know your stuff, because people, you know, in this climate, you know, people demand that their developers actually have a proven track record, which luckily we have, et cetera. But, you know, it's rough out there. So you got to do your homework and do your diligence.
Definitely. And I guess on the flip side of that, this may have go back to your answer a few minutes ago, but for yourself or for other Kickstarter projects you've seen, are there any major red flags that people should be aware of when they're designing their Kickstarter project?
Well, just remember the Kickstarter /Stripe takes 10% right off the bat, so don't count on that money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's a good one. That's the only one that comes to mind all of a sudden, like red flags.
Mm-hmm.
Picking, packing, and shipping of physical rewards is a really big deal, and you got to account for that too.
Yeah.
You know, that's about it. Make sure you know what the hell you're making.
All right. And my last question regarding Kickstarter for you, Mitch, is this is another one I like to ask all of our developers, and that is regarding Kickstarter sustainability. Do you think that Kickstarter in its current form will remain a sustainable option for game development, or do you think it may have to change or evolve over time?
Well, you know, it's funny. When we did Shadowrun Returns, we kind of rushed because we assumed after Double Fines that Kickstarter would last maybe 6 months.
Mm.
So, and that was in 2012. So who the hell am I to predict anymore? Because we didn't think Kickstarter would be around by now. We thought the bottom would drop out a long time ago, because somebody would screw up and, you know, a whole bunch of people would get burned and then the bloom would be off the rose. So, you know, will it evolve? Of course it'll evolve. It has to. Just this co-funding model, for example, that we pioneered with Hong Kong and again with BattleTech, you have to find a new way to do it for someone like ourselves that are returning. And for new people, That's a tough business. So where's it going? Oh, who knows?
All right. Before we move on to our final topic then, Mitch, are there any other parts of Kickstarter that we didn't discuss, whether it be with Shadowrun, BattleTech, or with the platform in general that you would like to talk about?
Well, just the last thing that everybody needs to realize is you know when a Kickstarter is going south when you stop hearing from the game developer. Mm. Right. When they stop doing updates, you know they're hiding something. And that's just, you know, it's like, oh, shit got bad, you know, and we can't tell our audience. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, yeah, you can. As a matter of fact, you know, you probably should. Yeah. And that can be really hard. Yeah. But, you know, it's just a matter of you need to keep your audience in the loop with you. You want to keep, you know, what's great is finding that balance between signal and noise. Mm-hmm. You know, there are so many kicks. Yeah, I back a lot of Kickstarters, and you get so many, you know, email updates from them that after a while you just start deleting them without even reading them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for us, we try and make sure to have that healthy balance of keep you in the loop, keep you entertained, show you some behind the scenes of why games are, or how games are made, but not so often that you stop reading them, you know, when you stop appreciating them.
Yes.
So maybe once a month, but, you know, we've gone as long as 3 months without an update, I think. Well, no, maybe 8 weeks without an update before people are like, hey, where's there an update? And we do that for a couple of reasons. One is so that we don't, you know, fill the audience's inboxes all the time. But the other one is because the people making those updates are stopping making the game to do it. Mm-hmm. So you just got to, you know, there's a level between, you know, the right level of focus and the right level of information and communication and entertainment. So it's a balancing act.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Yeah, this has definitely been a fantastic cast so far. And as I said earlier, we could really just sit here and talk for like 2-3 hours if need be. But yeah, I know you guys definitely have a Kickstarter to get back to. I'm sure you probably have family and dinner waiting for you at some point. So I don't want to take...
Well, my family works at the studio, so it's easier.
Oh, that's good then. But I'm sure you will eventually want to leave the studio and go home, so I don't want to keep you until the wee hours of the morning there. So for our final topic then, we'll talk a little bit more specifically about BattleTech and what you guys have planned for it. And I'm sure this is going to be very interesting. As we've talked about over the cast, you guys have definitely developed a solid development process and routine around Kickstarters and about developing a game with the crowdfunding model. As we've said in the previous section, BattleTech was funded with this quote-unquote co-funded mindset, where you guys were going to make the game, you know, come hell or high water, even if you got zero funding from it. But you basically let the audience decide how far do you want us to go with it, and it has definitely gone far. As we've said earlier, at the time of this recording, you guys have just broken the 2 million mark, and who knows what you'll hit when the actual campaign is over. So, to get started then, for people who haven't heard of BattleTech before and all that, what is the game, and I guess, in a nutshell, why are so many people excited about bringing back this classic series?
Well, that's a great question. I think the thing I really want to focus on is why are so many people so excited about this? Mm-hmm. And that's great. Mm-hmm. For one thing, BattleTech is a 32-year-old game setting. Mm-hmm. And it was originally started as a tabletop miniatures game. And it went on from there to be all sorts of different entertainment types, from Mech Warrior through Mech Warrior 4, which is this cockpit experience where you're actually simulating driving one of these giant battle mechs, to the Mech Commander series that I made, which is this sort of top-down battlefield control of a small army of these mechs, to cartoons, to trading cards, to those HeroClix games that my partner Jordan made, to the BattleTech pods, which was kind of like precursor of virtual reality.
Yes, I was looking at your Kickstarter video before, and I go, I heard this series before, but I never played it. And then you brought up those BattleTech bombs, like, oh my god, I played that like one time someone's birthday party in like '95 or something.
I was a regular customer. I played in one of the very first prototypes, if not the first prototype, at it wasn't Game Developers Conference, that didn't exist. It was the Consumer Electronics Show in the 80s. I was one of the first players of that. It was just great. Anyway, you can see it's been all of these things, including over 200 novels, comic books, you know, source books, technical readouts, cats and dogs living together, you know, total anarchy. And, you know, what some people know and other people don't is that BattleTech was, you know, Star Wars before Star Wars, you know. Oh, actually it was after Star Wars, but it's this sprawling epic game setting, you know, that lasts over hundreds of years in the game setting, and people play it in different game settings and different time periods. And, there's all sorts of changes that take place in it. It's sort of like Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all of these noble houses all vying for control of that one, you know, throne, for control of the universe. You know, it's that big. And I think there's a lot to that. But not only is it all about this sweeping epic of all of these noble houses vying for this throne, it goes all the way down to the individual soldier level, right? So just like, you know, the Starks are playing their game, here the Hound is out there doing his thing, right? And they all exist at the same time. And that's one of the reasons why BattleTech has been around so long, because people affiliate or, identify with both the houses but all the way down to different mercenary units or different military units to the individual characters in it. And so I think that's one of the reasons why it's lived so long. And notice I didn't say battle mechs very much when I said that. That's the tool. Think of this as these are, you know, knights and stuff, you know, with a K, knights, but their armor and their horse are one thing. Mm. Yeah, their armor, their nice and knight, their horse and their lance equal a battle mech. And so it's not just about giant stompy robots bashing on each other and shooting at each other. It's far more than that. However, if you like giant stompy robots, we got that, you know, in spades. Yeah. So, it feels real. It feels lived in. It feels grounded. And that's why BattleTech's so popular and has stayed around for so long.
Amazing. How many books did you say were written in the BattleTech universe?
Like about 200.
Wow. Amazing. And And this, of course, started, you said, in the early 90s, right? The original or before
that? Like I said, it's 32 years ago. 88, I think, something like that.
And it's amazing to see a game.
Sorry, 84. 84.
Wow.
My apologies.
1 year before
math,
I
got people for that.
And
all right.
it's amazing to talk about a game like this that has such a huge lore and world building sense to it. When we look at games that have gone with this kind of lore and world building, these types of games didn't really start showing up, at least traditionally, until like the early thousands, you know, stuff like World of Warcraft. And even like something like Team Fortress, what we talked about earlier in the cast, with the amount of world building they've done with that game to give its own internal universe, the comic books, the people, the whole that.
And, well, that's why our Shadowrun games are so successful also.
And I am a huge fan of games that really go for that sense of world building and the lore behind things. When you're not just saying, oh, this guy is bad because he's bad. He's bad because of, and you have, you know, a massive explanation. You have this whole internal world build up, and it gives you a stronger narrative, I would say, when you have that behind your game, rather than just saying, he's bad, you're good, go fight him.
Without a doubt. Yeah. You know, people want context.
Yeah. Definitely. Now, going back to the game in terms of the design, as we talked about in the previous section, as you approach developing BattleTech, you were already going to make this game no matter what, going back with the whole co-funded aspect. So for people listening who may be coming back to this maybe a few months and they've just heard of BattleTech, if you guys didn't get 1 cent out of just some strange and horrific circumstance, what was the original format of BattleTech going to be?
It's exactly what we show on our Kickstarter page for stage one, mm-hmm. the skirmish game. So basically, you would get a mech lab where you could, you know, get a mech, mm-hmm. and you could outfit it. You could equip it with different weapons, mm-hmm. You know, and different systems. You could decide which mech warrior you wanted to put in that based on that mech warrior's strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. But you would marry them together. You put them, you create a lance of 4 mechs, and then you would choose a map to fight on, choose a mission objective, choose enemy AI to fight, maybe even the makeup of that enemy force, so you know exactly what you're getting, etc. Choose the difficulty level and play it out and see how you did. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, tweak your mechs and try it again and just keep escalating, mm-hmm. your own difficulty. So think of it kind of like a mech simulation toy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, of course, as we've said, things have definitely gotten a lot bigger since then. I have the Kickstarter page up right now. So obviously you have, you know, expand environments, and then the entire single-player story campaign has been funded. So
true.
Things have definitely gotten a lot bigger. And as you were saying of like 5 minutes ago, you're just at the point where you're adding the expanded mercenary campaign with customizable home base and stuff like that. And it definitely sounds like a lot. It definitely sounds really fascinating to what it's going to be.
I'm a big fan of it. Yeah. You know, one of the big things about the expanded mercenary campaign, one of the reasons why I'm so excited about it, is because it's open-ended. Mm. So even after the story finishes, you can keep playing because we're going to have a procedurally generated contract nice. Creator for making more mercenary contracts, and you can keep playing the game.
Nice. And that kind of stuff is always makes me excited about games, when you have a system built in to give it a lot more replayability, and you can do a lot with that compared to a single-player campaign, or I'm sorry, a story-based campaign, where mm-hmm. you can really only tell that story only a number of ways, but with procedurally generated design, that can go on for as long as someone's invested in the game.
That's the hope.
Yep. And for this next question, again, as someone who hasn't followed too much with the BattleTech style of gameplay, what
sure.
type of like gameplay systems, or how does a general game of BattleTech play out for someone like me who hasn't really gotten into this universe other than the virtual reality pods almost 20 years ago?
Sure. Well, again, what happens is you'll get a mission briefing from some person in the BattleTech universe, and it'll be in the form of a contract negotiation. They'll say, hey, we want you to do this, mm-hmm. and you can say, well, it'll cost you this much, or you negotiate different aspects of it, like who pays for ammo or whatever. Mm-hmm. And after you've done that, then you decide which mechs you're going to take with you based on the limitations of the contract. And then you start tweaking out your mechs. You could either, you know, use them straight off the rack, but a lot of people really like messing with the loadouts of their mechs, mm-hmm. to really customize them. And of course, you could customize the look and feel of the mechs too, which is really nice. You will train your mech warriors to grow their skills so that you can balance your forces for different little specialties, be it, you know, long range or with different mech chassis, mm-hmm. as we call them, or, you know, different weapon systems, etc. Mm-hmm. And so you'll do that. You may, for example, have a couple of mech warriors in the mech bay, in the med bay, you know, getting healed after the last one, and you have to use more of your green guys while the other ones heal. Mm-hmm. But once you've decided which mechs you're using and how you've customized them and which mech warriors and how you've trained them up, then you deploy them onto the battlefield into a game of turn-based combat. And turn-based combat, you know, there will be 4 mechs in your lance, and occasionally we may give you more units than just those 4. You know, you have to escort this particular unit, or we give you a small complement of tanks or something like that. Or maybe part of your contract involves escorting some allies, and you get control of those allies as well, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you proceed to do your mission objectives in whatever order. You know, it could be, you know, knock out this facility. It's like harass the enemy in this particular one. So I'm going to go and I'm going to knock out their communications. That's one of my mission objectives. I'm going to go blow up a fuel tank, you know, so that we deny them fuel for their forces. Maybe another thing you'll do in the same mission would be to go ambush the leader of the enemy faction so that they're more in disarray, etc. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you play it out in turn-based mode. And I guess the closest analog right now would be XCOM Enemy Unknown, but that doesn't go nearly into the depth of strategic game or tactical gameplay that we plan on doing. But it's an idea. At least it's turn-based. It's kind mm-hmm. of cinematic and, you know, visceral and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But with far more depth than that, because there's a lot going on with battle mechs, and we really want to make it so that the way we talk about it is, you know, it's not a fiddly game, but it's a game that you can fiddle with and have fun with. So pretty exciting time.
Definitely. And excuse me, I'm glad you mentioned XCOM Enemy Unknown, because it's very interesting to see how that game really made a mark for being a turn-based strategy title when the market seems to have really died, at least in terms of AAA development. We see a lot of people...
Well, I would say that's not a AAA game necessarily, you know. But, you know, when you think AAA, you think more on the lines of Destiny and things like that, you know, $350 million games. But the way I think about it is that is a modern turn-based game. The way a lot of people think of turn-based games are hex-based, moving chits around, you know, et cetera, and it being kind of grognardy and you know, very numbers-oriented. And that's not our intention. You know, that level of detail will be there. The idea is that you will have levels of abstraction of the interface such that you could play it at whatever depth you want to play the game at. And that's an important thing. So if you want to play a quick game and not think too much, you can do that. But on the higher difficulties, you got to be paying attention to, you know, the more subtle aspects of the game. But, you know, XCOM, the reason I brought it up is because it is an example of a modern game as opposed to something like Panzer General.
Oh, yeah.
It was a great game, but you can't call that one modern. We want something that's visceral and exciting and turn-based.
And still has that depth there for people who want it, but you're not going to be overwhelmed by it if you're just starting to play the game for the first time.
And that's exactly the nature of what we're doing. The depth is there, and that's what turn-based gives you.
Yeah.
It gives you time to make your decisions. You know, when you're playing Mech Commander, which is a real-time game, you know, you're making split-second decisions, unless later on, you know, in Mech Commander 2, we allowed the ability to pause and issue orders while paused. Some people might consider that cheating. I consider it audience service, especially for people like me who aren't good Twitch gamers.
Oh, yeah. I've lost my real-time strategy Twitch skills a long time ago. I can't...
Yeah, me too.
I cannot play, like, StarCraft 2 anymore. I will get killed no matter what.
Nah, I can't even play it single player.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah, definitely. I'm looking at the list, and one thing I'm just curious about, now, again, for those of you listening, we are recording in the middle of Kickstarter, but the last component of the Expanded Mercenary Campaign is Legendary Mechs and Mech Warriors. What does that mean, again, for someone who's not too familiar with the universe?
Sure. Well, because the Battletech has been around for so long, and the Battletech history, you know, the mythology of it, or the narrative of it is so rich. There are, and because it's also kind of like this sort of knights in shining armor sort of thing, just like there are named swords in fiction, like Narsil or Anduril and the Lord of the Rings, there are these mechs that are these sort of famous, handed down from generation to generation. You know, mechs are not...
dime a dozen?
Ubiquitous, yeah. They're not a dime a dozen, you know, especially because there's a lot of lost technology. So as history goes on, technology actually goes down. Mm-hmm. And it's the older stuff that's the good stuff. The new stuff is kind of crappy. So these older battle mechs are just coveted, you know, and they're precious and mm-hmm. rare. And some of them are named, and they're handed down from generation to generation. That's how you get a legendary mech,
okay.
Because it's got that history. And then, you know, legendary mech warrior, well, that seems pretty obvious. It would be somebody either from the fiction or, you know, legendary in this particular part of space that we happen to set our story in.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
It's a universe, after all.
Definitely. All right. It really does sound fascinating. As I said, I'm not too familiar with the Scope universe itself, but you guys have definitely painted a very fantastic picture. And again, as we've said, the Kickstarter has been pretty much an overwhelming success at this point. I'm really excited to see what you guys are going to do with it, especially with, as we're talking right now, again, you're about stage 3.5 of the way there.
Yeah, that should be fun. For those of you who are interested, we're doing a live Twitch Q&A on Monday, November 1st. I think it's the 1st or the 2nd. It's the day before our Kickstarter ends. It kicks off the final 24 hours. And that we've done these before. They're really fun. Show up. Not only will you hear about the BattleTech Kickstarter or what we're going to do about the game, and you could ask questions about the game, but what a lot of people have been doing is asking us questions about game development in general and that kind of thing, and creativity and managing creative people. So that's interesting.
Oh, yes.
But also, this one was unlocked by our fans, and this one is an alcohol fueled live stream,
and that always means added fun.
It will be something.
Yes, it will be something.
Yeah.
I guess one other question. Oh, yeah. Here's, I guess, my last general question about BattleTech, at least before we start to wrap things up. As we talked about with the Shadowrun and Shadowrun Hong Kong, you guys had additional ideas, additional concepts. Now, of course, this may be way too soon to talk about, but have you thought about, I guess, any kind of expanding this game or going beyond that 18-month development cycle, or is it still very too soon to tell at this moment?
No. I'm not going to go very far forward in history, but if you think about the games as a service comment that we had earlier, anything above 2.5 million that we get will go directly towards our live team that will be supporting the game post-launch and adding more features. The number one most requested feature that we are going to in success add post-launch would be co-op multiplayer.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
But that's as far as I'm going to go with our future plans.
Okay. Before we get to my final series of questions to wrap the cast up with, are there any specific topics or elements behind BattleTech that I didn't talk about or forgot that you would like to bring up now, Mitch?
Our BattleTech game, BattleTech Kickstarter. Let's see. It's giant robots, big 32-year history, studio that's made these things before and is dependable. No, we covered the stuff.
Awesome. Okay. Mitch, it has definitely been a pleasure talking to you today. And again, we could spend another 2-3 hours, but I believe it is time to start to wrap things up. So I just have a few last general set of questions for you, and then we will say goodbye.
All right.
So I guess the first one then is, as we've said, you are planning on this 18-month development cycle or thereabout for BattleTech. For people listening to this cast right now, do you have a set or fuzzy release date for the game now that it has definitely been funded?
Well, you have to. Yeah. In order to put something on Kickstarter, you have to give an estimated release date. They don't allow open-ended development. Yeah. So what our Kickstarter says, our estimated release date is May of 2017.
Okay. And keeping with that, and keeping with crowdfunding in general, are you planning on putting BattleTech on, like, Steam, or, I'm sorry, like, on Early Access, or will just be remain for, like, people who pledge for, like, Alpha or Beta Access?
So, we will not be doing Steam Early Access, or we have no intention of it. Obviously, the game will come out for Steam and on GOG and on Humble. If you are a backer at the $50 level or above, That comes with beta access to the skirmish game. Mm-hmm. And if we are lucky enough to unlock PvP multiplayer, PvP multiplayer beta will also be included in that.
Okay. And besides being on the PC, are you planning on like Mac, Linux, or console releases for it?
Yeah, so it'll be Windows, Macs, and Linux, but okay. Not console.
All right. And let me see if there's anything else regarding just general stuff. Oh, I guess for my general last question then, as we've talked about Harebrained Schemes, this is Kickstarter number 4. Have you guys started thinking about a fifth Kickstarter at this point, or is that too secretive at this right now?
No, it's not secretive. We just haven't. Okay. we have another game that we're releasing early next year called Necropolis. Mm-hmm. And you can find that at necropolisgame.com. Take a look at that. It's completely different than anything else we've done, whether it's Golem Arcane or Shadowrun. Necropolisgame.com is Necropolis. Is a roguelike, you know, where death is imminent and it's just going to happen and see how far you can go. But this is a 3D action game. Mm. Imagine like Spelunky meets Dark Souls. And you got to see it because the art is delicious and the gameplay controls are great. We've shown it at PAX East and just recently at PAX Prime, and everybody went nuts over it. So that'll be coming out next year, but we're not going to Kickstarter that. Okay. That one.
All right. Oh, yeah, definitely keep me abreast of that, because Spelunky meets Dark Souls, you just made me very happy hearing those two words.
Yeah, together. It's got a nice sense of humor to it, and again, the gameplay is really solid.
All right. In that case, Mitch, to end this cast on, do you have any final thoughts about anything we've talked about, or anything you'd like to say to the fans listening?
Yeah, I guess the only thing that I'd like to say to the folks listening is, you know, we are an independent game studio of passionate game developers. We are not rich by anyone's standards. As a matter of fact, all the people in this studio make below what we call market value. Mm. We're out here making games because we love it, and this is the lifestyle we want. And so what we're looking for really is to be your favorite garage band. Mm. Right. And we'd like you to follow our games and share them and talk about them with other people. And just know that if we haven't made a game for you, think of it as we haven't made a game for you yet.
Mm. Yep. Definitely a great sentiment to end on, Mitch. So we're going to end things here for the cast. I guess for me, just to say to you and to the rest of Harebrained, I definitely want to give you guys a round of applause for not just being a one-time successful Kickstarter developer, but doing this at this current moment 4 times. And I love talking to passionate people like yourselves who are in this for the love of design, for the love of creating content and mechanics and systems and all that that you really do want to see. It's always great to hear about people working on their passion projects, the stuff they're dreaming of making. And it just really rubs off on the people you talk to. And like I said, I'm not huge on BattleTech before. I didn't really hear about it other than those virtual reality pods. But I'm definitely excited to see what you guys will do with BattleTech when it's eventually released. So,
thank you.
Definitely, again, congratulations to you and the rest of Harebrained. And yeah, I would love to talk to you and the rest of the co-founders again at some point. We definitely have so many more topics to talk about.
Yeah, I get it. Oh yeah, it's a complex industry.
Definitely. All right. So with that, we are going to wrap things up. If you are listening to this cast at the time of its posting, the BattleTech Kickstarter should have just a few more days left. So be sure to check that out. There will be a link to it in the podcast notes below. So, again, Mitch, I would like to thank you so much for coming on today. I don't even have to wish you good luck anymore. So, again, I can't wait to see the game, and especially in Necropolis. That also sounds very fascinating.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I appreciate, we do need luck, because now we have to actually make the game.
Of course. Now the tough part starts.
Yeah, exactly. We worked really hard to get the right to work really hard.
All right, definitely. So for those of you listening, thanks so much for tuning in. And if you would like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options currently available. If you'd like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. To contribute to our ongoing Patreon campaign to secure some much-needed monthly funding, you can click on the Patreon banner or search for me on Patreon under Josh Spicer or GameWisdom, and any donations would be greatly appreciated. And last but not least, please check out the YouTube channel and Twitch stream to watch plays of video games either live or recorded. You can find me on Twitch most nights at 10 Eastern under GW Bicer, and the YouTube link should be on the front page. So, again, thanks so much for tuning in to this great cast, and we have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.